Her eyes were so bleak and her shoulders so defeated that Ronan wrapped his arms around her. "I'm not a doll, Ronan Lynch," she said, her voice muffled. "Take your hands off me." He just hugged her tighter, though, as she cried into his chest. A few minutes later, Bride came out, looking worn and blank, Ronan's and Hennessy's bags over his shoulders. "Call your brother," he told Ronan. "Tell him we can see them for a few hours." 29. A special kind of relationship happened between an artist and a piece of art on account of the investment. Sometimes it was an emotional investment. The subject matter meant something to the artist, making every stroke of the brush weightier than it looked. It might be a technical investment. It was a new method, a hard angle, an artistic challenge that meant no success on the canvas could be taken for granted. And sometimes it was simply the sheer investment of time. Art took hours, days, weeks, years of single-minded focus. This investment meant that everything that touched the art-making experience got absorbed. Music, conversations, or television shows experienced during the making became part of the piece, too. Hours, days, weeks, years later, the memory of one could instantly invoke the memory of the other, because they had been inextricably joined. Copying and recopying Sargent's Madam X would always be associated with Hennessy, because of how intensely the two of them had worked on making it, the process so intensely tangled that it was as if a single entity, Jordan Hennessy, had done it. Copying Sargent's The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd would forever be associated with June and the other girls, because of how it was the first time Jordan had truly imagined doing something original, thinking of how a portrait of all of Hennessy's girls could be posed with a similar chaotic but structured array for good effect, their faces strikingly and eerily and poignantly the same. Copying Neil Lynch's The Dark Lady would forever be associated with the fairy market and the creeping desperation of those last days with Hennessy before the murders. And copying Sargent's El Jaleo would forever be grief and hope twined together. It was knotted tightly with the song that was leading the charts the first week she got to Boston, the bright new knowledge that sweet metals existed, the sound of that little boy's voice when he woke up at the Boudicca party, the quality of the light coming into the Blix as she bought new brushes to replace the ones she'd lost, the heart-pattering chance that artists just might be able to keep themselves awake if they were original enough. Jordan was beginning to understand how it might be possible for lay energy to be tangled into the art-making process, too. "Of course, Ronan can't tell me exactly when he'll be here," Declan said. The sentence came quite out of the blue, as before that he had, in his sing-song soothing patter, been telling her about quantum blue, a new blue pigment invented with nanotechnology designed to replicate the exact color of the idyllic blue hour of a Greek dusk. He was still seated in his chair, the way he always sat when he came over, one leg crossed over the other, his tie loosened, his jacket removed and laid over his knee, as if he had just come in from work, because usually he had. She hadn't told him the portrait was done, so he still posed. "It is not the Ronan Lynch way to provide enough information to prepare." "What's it exactly that you're hoping to prepare for?" Jordan asked. She herself had mixed feelings about the news that Ronan, Bride, and Hennessy were paying a visit to Boston because of one harsh fact. Hennessy still hadn't called. 10 years of complete codependence, and suddenly Hennessy had gone radio silent. At first she'd put it down to Hennessy being unable to find Jordan once she'd moved to Boston and gotten a burner phone. But now, Declan had gotten two calls from Ronan, and Jordan still didn't have even a message from Hennessy. Jordan went from worry to annoyance to zen and back again. Truthfully, what truly kept her up nights was the realization that Hennessy hadn't given Jordan all of her memories when she made her. She had been waiting weeks to demand an answer for that, and the call never came. Declan said, "I've never been good at Ronan, and there's no handbook for the conversation we need to have now." "Sure, there is. It's a snap, a quick group read. The handbook's called, Your Boyfriend Called. He Thinks You've Joined a Cult. Please Advise." "Ronan's not much of a reader," Declan said darkly. "I don't want to talk about it." "You brought it up." "Did I? What was I talking about before?"
"Quantum Blue, Alexa Pulu, Blue Hour."
Jordan knew, without having to think too hard about it, that this conversation would also be coded into the painting currently in front of her. Portrait of a Nameless Man. She would forever after see the words Quantum Blue and think of this canvas, these long, cold nights at the borrowed Fenway studio. Declan Lynch posed in the leather chair, the lights of the city murmuring outside the tall windows behind him. It would forever be tied to her experimentation on the colorful edges in the piece, her decision-making for the palette, her favorite brush getting scrubbed down to nothing and being replaced with a second favorite, and with her attempt to make people feel about her subject the way she felt about her subject, no matter how many decades passed. Her first original. Had she made a sweet medal? She didn't know. Declan observed, "You can put that brush down, although it's very good theater. I know the painting's done." "Who's the artist here, Mr. Potsey? Perhaps I'm still studying your mannerisms." "That brush hasn't had paint on it for 3 days." "It's not your place to question my process. Muses are notoriously ill-used." She put the brush down. "Matthew said you might be able to get one of your father's dreams to test it." "You can't tell?" "Whatever Bride and them are doing means I can't feel the sweet metals like I used to. I don't need them, not just walking around. I won't know unless the worst happens." "Did it feel different to make it?" "Of course it had. It was her first original, and for the first several sessions, the weight of that had slowed her brush to a crawl. She couldn't decide how many of her artistic decisions in the piece were being cleverly informed by the artist she'd painted before, and how many were simply straight-up copied. This was decidedly Turner's palette, she argued with herself. This was Sargent's composition. This was still forgery. Just good forgery. But then something had happened on the third sitting. Declan had been telling her a story of John White Alexander's Study in Black and Green, telling her how sensational it was at the time it was painted, given that the subject of the painting was a woman whose husband murdered her former lover in the middle of Madison Square Garden and got away with it under a plea of temporary insanity. As a footnote, he'd added that John White Alexander was married to Elizabeth Alexander Alexander, a woman who friends had introduced him to at a party because they had the same last name. Jordan had laughed, and her brush, loaded with titanium white, had slipped. Disaster! Before she could stop it, she darted a glaring line along the edge of Declan's neck on the canvas. With annoyance, she'd gone in with a rag, but the paint beneath was still too wet to let her completely wipe away her mistake. The edge had been left glowing, but as she turned her head to the side, trying to imagine the fewest steps required to restore the edge, she realized the glow actually looked good. It did not look like reality. It felt like reality. The way the light played against the dark tricked her eye in the same way a real object's edges did. The dissonance was right. Instead of repairing it, she emphasized it as much as she dared. The next sitting, she was even braver. She pushed the effect further, past the point of comfort, until it was more real than reality. She didn't know if the effect would work, because she was no longer copying. This was unknown road. Had it felt different to make it? Of course it had felt different. It felt terrifying. It felt thrilling. She wanted people to admire it. She was afraid they'd hate it. A Jordan Hennessy original. "It's bonkers, really," Jordan remarked. "The whole thing. A sweet metal. Everyone's going mad trying to get one. They're so rare, it's impossible. And here I am, thinking, oh, right, well, I'll just make one then. I never thought of myself as an egotist, but I really must have quite a pair on me." Declan smiled at this, turning his face away as he did, as always. "I'm just surprised you never considered yourself an egotist."
"That's very sweet," he asked.
"Can I see it?"
"No."
"Why not?" "Because you're the biggest art snob I know, which is saying a lot, and you're a capital L liar, and I don't think I could take it if you didn't like it, and I also don't think I could take you lying to me about it if you didn't." With some curiosity, Declan asked, "Do you think I could still lie convincingly to you?"
"I don't see why not."
"Do you think I would?"
"I don't see why not."
"After all this?"
"After all what?"
she said, but in a mocking tone. "Just because I stole your car." They were quiet then for a space. Declan looked out the window at the dark, more pensive than his portrait. Both real Declan and portrait Declan held their hands the same way, fingers unevenly laced, something about them suggesting power at rest. But portrait Declan depicted the Declan of just a few minutes before. His head turned quickly to hide that secret smile, that private self. Portrait Declan's eyes were half-lidded, looking away, his expression one of intimate, mannered amusement. Real Declan's were wide open, mirthless.
"My mother took days to fall asleep after my father died," Declan said.
It took Jordan a moment to realize that he was referring to the dreamt Aurora, not his biological mother, Moracora. It was the first time she remembered him doing so.
"He was dead right away, of course. Brains bashed in. They had to take some of the gravel driveway with him to clean up the scene, if you can imagine. That's your job, the shovel. Make sure you get all the pieces. Don't want the kids tripping over gray matter. They didn't take my mother, though, because she didn't look dead yet. She looked fine. Fine as you could expect under the circumstances. No, it took her days. She ran down like a battery. The further she got away from him, the longer it had been since he was alive, the less she became, until she was just asleep."
It was not his ordinary storytelling voice. There was no theater. He was looking at nothing.
"Ronan and Matthew wanted her awake again, of course. Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't you? Truly, why wouldn't you? I see that now. I see it from their point of view. But Ronan and I fought. I said it wouldn't matter. She was nothing without Dad. Always an accessory to him, a reaction to him. Why wake her? You couldn't wake the dead along with her, so she'd always be a frame for a destroyed painting. We were orphans the moment Dad died because she was just organ death. What was she except for what Dad made her to be? What could she do except what he had made her to do? She had to love us. She was always just an external hard drive for his feelings. She..."
"Just stop," Jordan said. "You have to know now. Saying she wasn't real doesn't make it any easier. Just different. Anger doesn't mess up mascara as much."
His eyes were bright, but he blinked, and they were ordinary again. Ronan's trying to wake up the world. I'm trying to think of how to talk him out of it, but what he's talking about is a world where she never fell asleep. A world where Matthew's just a kid. A world where it doesn't matter what Hennessy does if something happens to her. A level playing field. I don't think it's a good idea, but it's not like I can't see the appeal, because now I'm biased. I'm too biased to be clear. Declan shook his head a little. I said I would never become my father, anything like him. And now look at me. At us.
Ah, there it was.
It took no effort to remember the way he'd looked at her the first moment he realized she was a dream.
I'm a dream, Jordan said. I'm not your dream.
Declan put his chin in his hand and looked back out the window.
That, too, would be a good portrait. Perhaps it was just because she liked looking at him that she thought each pose would make a good one. A series. What a future that idea promised. Nights upon nights like this, him sitting there, her standing here.
By the time we're married, Declan said eventually, I want you to have applied for a different studio in this place because this man's paintings are very ugly. Her pulse gently skipped two beats before continuing on as before.
I don't have a social security number of my own, Potsy.
I'll buy you one, Declan said. You can wear it in place of a ring.
The two of them looked at each other past the canvas on her easel. Finally, he said, voice soft, I should see the painting now. Are you sure?
It's time, Jordan.
Putting his jacket to the side, he stood. He waited. He would not come around to look without an invite. It's time, Jordan.
Jordan had never been truly honest with anyone who didn't wear Hennessy's face. Showing him this painting, this original, felt like being more honest than she had ever been in her life.
She stepped back to give him room.
Declan took it in. His eyes flicked to and from the likeness, from the jacket on portrait Declan's leg to the real jacket he'd left behind on the chair. She watched his gaze follow the live edge she'd taken such care to paint, that subtle electricity of complementary colors at the edge of his form.
It's very good, Declan muttered.
Jordan, it's very good.
I thought it might be.
I don't know if it's a sweet metal, but you're very good.
I thought I might be.
The next one will be even better.
I think it might be.
And in 10 years, your scandalous masterpiece will get you thrown out of France, too, he said. And later you can triumphantly sell it to the Met. Children will have to write papers about you. People like me will tell stories about you to their dates at museums to make them think they're interesting.
She kissed him.
He kissed her. And this kiss, too, got all wrapped up in the art making of the portrait sitting on the easel beside them, getting all mixed in with all the other sights and sounds and feelings that had become part of the process. It was very good.
30.
Once upon a time, back when they lived in the nation's capital, Hennessy and Jordan had briefly run something called The Game. The game began at midnight at the River Road exit on I-495. Not once you'd taken the exit, at it, on the interstate, screaming by it. Bit of a fraught proposition with D.C. traffic. Underestimate the congestion and the would-be player would end up passing River Road minutes after everyone else had left. Overestimate it and the player showed up too early, hoping they didn't burn too much time looping around for another approach.
Easy?
No. But Hennessy had never been interested in easy.
At midnight, ready or not, here I come. Hennessy howled by the River Road exit, and whatever vehicle she'd taken from the McLean mansion or temporarily lifted, Pied Pipering a restless parade of horsepower to the location of the game. The other girls, June, etc., would already be in place, two of them bookending start and finish, the rest stationed at exits. The usual tricks in the bag, police band radio, radar detectors, 14 keen eyes. Then they raced, point to point, drags, drifts, two up, four up, whatever burned at Hennessy that night. Sometimes when it was Hennessy, it was actually Jordan. Sometimes it was both. The stakes of the game were always high. Sometimes the prize was drugs, weapons, the loser's car, a year's rent in someone's really posh second home, goods too hot to sell on the open market. The drivers, the players, the pawns, they were all of a certain type. 20 and 30-something men who only came alive after dark, usually white and swish enough to be able to survive any traffic infraction that might come their way, all of them driving cars designed to do more than get HOV lane violations. They congregated in forums to discuss the game, to offer up prizes for the next, to talk smack and measure dicks. At first they were all area marks, but eventually people would come from up and down the 95 corridor in hopes of rolling into the game. Hennessy and Jordan usually just moderated the race for a cut of the prizes, but when the girls needed cash or were intrigued by one of the offerings, they raced too. Hennessy was good at it because she had no fear and no inhibitions. Jordan was better at it because she did. Together they were known as the Valkyrie, although a few of the more observant return players called them the Valkyries. The game broke a shit ton of rules. Hennessy loved it, or at least she loved that she couldn't think of anything else while she was doing it. That was as close as she got to happiness. She thought it was probably the best she could hope for.
Get in. Hurry up. Time is a waterfall, and the moment we're trying to catch is rapidly swimming toward the edge, Hennessy said.
Hennessy? Jordan asked, shocked.
Jordan Hennessy stood on the dark sidewalk near Fenway Studios, her bag slung over her shoulder, looking sleek in urbane with her natural hair pulled back into a high ponytail, slim-shouldered leather jacket, orange crop top, sharp black leggings, subtle chevron-patterned flats. Jordan Hennessy also sat behind the wheel of a thrumming Toyota Supra on the curb, looking camera-ready with huge hair, deep purple lips, a man's bomber jacket, a deep purple corset, and heels that seemed difficult to operate a clutch with. These two Jordan Hennessys shared identical septum rings, identical floral tattoos across their hands, nearly identical floral tattoos around their throats. But no one would mistake them for the same person.
You didn't call, bruv, Jordan said.
In.
Jordan got in.
She had changed a little since Hennessy had seen her, but not so much that Hennessy couldn't read her expression. It was a nuanced thing, this expression. Shock was the primary flavor. Then there was a note of relief. And then, just on the back of the tongue, wariness. All of this was expected. What Hennessy hadn't expected to see was joy. It had radiated from Jordan before she'd seen Hennessy. She'd been walking the sidewalk in the damned middle of the night with a grin on her face, a grin she kept trying to put away but kept escaping. Somehow, Jordan had been living here in Boston, away from Hennessy, and she had not only been okay, but she'd been so okay that happiness was bursting out of her, and she couldn't stop anyone from being able to see it. Hennessy had been pulling out the lace, and Jordan had been happy. Hennessy didn't know what to do with this, so she started to prattle.
She prattled as she sent the supra down the street and Jordan put her bag on the floor by her feet like she always did. She prattled as she sent the supra onto the highway and Jordan rolled up the window so that the increasing wind would stop beating her hair around. She prattled as they were joined by several other heavily muscled cars in the tunnels under Boston Harbor. She prattled as Jordan eyed the other cars and then put her seatbelt on.
"How much notice did you give them?" Jordan asked. She wasn't stupid. She recognized the game when she saw it.
5 hours, Hennessy said, on that mad Nootropics investment banker Slack. Do you remember that one? That means there is a very good chance statistically that one of these drivers is currently totally mashed on some completely unregulated South American plant byproduct.
They burst west out of Boston at a speed several ticks above proper. They had acquired quite a contingent of impressive cars. Flat cars, wide cars, flanking, waiting.
The game was getting ready to whisk Hennessy's feelings away. It hadn't yet, but it was going to.
It had to.
She didn't know what she had wanted out of seeing Jordan again, but not this. Some part of her had always known that if she called, Jordan would be doing okay without her. Knew that if she showed up, Jordan would be doing okay without her. Knew that if there was a way for their lives to be separated, Jordan would be doing okay without her. Knew that it was Hennessy who couldn't live without Jordan. She supposed she had hoped she was wrong. As the cars gathered and revved, Jordan asked, "How can we run a game? There's no one to guard the exits. They're all dead."
"It ruins the fun when you say that, so I'm going to pretend you didn't," Hennessy said.
"Also, I've already thought about that, and as they say, planned accordingly. It's a straight shot. Starts with the triple flash of the lights, and then it's on for exactly 7 miles. No exits in between. If we're clear when it starts, we should be still by the end. No surprises for us. We'll have a grand old time."
"We? Are we racing?"
"Yes."
"Hennessy," Jordan said, "there's a GTR right there. A new 911 behind it. I can't see that thing 2 cars back because it's too damn flat, but my pheromones suggest it's a McLaren. Are you just planning on watching taillights?"
But she didn't sound angry. She never sounded angry. She was always up for whatever madness Hennessy was into. Wasn't this better, Hennessy thought. Wasn't this how it should have been?
Her and Jordan. Hennessy setting that timer on her phone, staying awake for as long as possible, never seeing the lace.
"We should do this again," Hennessy said.
"We are doing it again.
I mean, you and me. I mean, Jordan, Hennessy. You should come with us, or I should come light up Boston. Except seriously, can we do New York instead? Because this place is like a hot girl's elbow pit. It's fine, but there's not a lot to do."
"You been sleeping, Heloise?" Jordan asked.
The question was absolutely intolerable. All of it. The content, the timing, the nickname.
"You been painting," Hennessy countered. "I can't help but notice some paint on your neck there. Looks like Tyrian purple."
It did not. It looked like ordinary white paint, but Tyrian purple was a better reference to Declan Lynch.
Jordan should have been irritated by Hennessy's misdirect, but instead her mouth whispered that smile again, the one Hennessy had seen on the sidewalk. She touched her fingers to her neck, feeling the paint, and the sweetness of the touch drove home the meaning of the smile.
She liked that asshole, that boring-ass drone of a prick. She liked him. Hennessy had begged Bride and Ronan to stop for the supra, knowing how much Jordan loved it. And here the two of them were on this midnight highway, the Valkyries, surrounded by several $1,000,000 of several thousands of horsepower. And Jordan was smiling over that dough-faced DC pig.
Some part of Hennessy was always looking at that old door without a handle.
A keyhole with no key in it. "Ready, set, go," Hennessy said. She flashed her lights. 1, 2, 3. The cars bolted. As Jordan had predicted, the Supra was nowhere near as fast as the speediest of the contenders. The tight pack swiftly loosened as the fit got fitter and the slow stayed slow. Jordan petted the dash of the Supra as if to make the car feel better about not leading the pack, and then in a different sort of voice she asked, "Did you dream me without memories of Jay?" The thing about the ley line getting stronger was that Hennessy felt she could see the lace even with her eyes open sometimes. "There's a neat trick we're going to do up here," Hennessy said. "Lacy shapes thrown by aftermarket headlights." "Hennessy," Jordan drew her back, "did you?" Lacy threads of pine needles caught under the Supra's wiper. Hennessy went on. "It's a fancy thing I nicked off Bride. Fancy little shit. It's got some fun side effects." Lacy shadows crisscrossing behind the streetlights racing by. Hennessy. Lacy eyelashes blink, blink, blinking. It looked like the pattern her mother's lamps had thrown across her studio wall. Rolling the window down, Hennessy scooped the little stolen silver orb out of the door pocket. She rolled it in her palm the way she'd seen Bride do when he wanted the orb to fly faster than it was being thrown, and then she hurled it into the dark. For a moment, there was no result, just taillights of cars all about to claim faster times than the Supra. The little orb zipped ahead of them. It unfolded. The cloud burst free. And then there was chaos. The cars spun, one here, one there. They smashed into each other. They nosed into the ditch. A Subaru flipped right over in the air. A Corvette spun and then slid backward nearly as fast as the Supra was going forward. It went for yards and yards. There was a high-pitched noise happening during all of this that keened and keened and keened, and Hennessy could not decide if it was her or Jordan or tires screaming. There were supercars everywhere, dazzled across the highway. Some nosed into others, the headlights pointed every which way. "We win," Hennessy said. She eased the Supra to a stop and pulled up the parking brake. Jordan was out of the car immediately, hands linked round the back of her neck, surveying the damage. Hennessy could tell she was horrified, and for some reason this was great. This was perfect. This was just what Hennessy wanted. This felt much better than Jordan's vague smile, her wild joy. Hennessy gestured grandly. "The prize is whichever we want. Which one do you fancy?" Jordan turned to her. "This isn't a dream." "I know," Hennessy said, "because I could control everything here." "Someone could be dead here." Jordan paced and then jogged across the asphalt, ducking her head to look in at this driver and that. They all gazed at her and past her, expressions swimming. Hennessy droned, "Asshole dies in a street race. News at 11. "This isn't a dream." "How about the Lambo?" Hennessy asked. "I feel like the Lambo would be the most fun." Jordan threw open the door of a sweet little busted-up Porsche as bright as Ronan's Skyblade. The driver was slumped over the wheel, which had crumpled in enough to press him back into his seat. His eyes looked at nothing. But it was hard to say if that was because of Bride's dreamt orb or because he was injured. "I don't want to steal cars and fuck shit up, Hennessy," Jordan snapped, rummaging until she found the seat controls. She worked to get the seat back enough to tug the man free. Hennessy didn't move a muscle as Jordan threw all of her weight to pull him out. "I've got a life here. I want to live my life, my real life. Art and growing up, and not this."
"Nice for you," Hennessy said.
"Why the hell are you being this way?" Jordan demanded. "This is what you came all this way for? The game?"
Hennessy looked at her as she propped the driver up against the wheel of his car and went to look at the next one.
I wish you were dead.
The sponge ordered need as a top.
What did you say?
I wish you died with the others, Hennessy said. It was awful. It was terrible. Her mouth wouldn't stop saying it. Her expression wouldn't stop being scathing. I wish you were all dead, so it would just be me, and I could do what I wanted. I can feel you dragging me down every second of every day. I'm so fucking tired of you.
Jordan's arms hung by her sides. She didn't look mad or hurt. She just stared, standing there in the middle of all the cars pointed helter-skelter.
You came here to tell me that?
Hennessy didn't know what she'd come here to do, but she'd done this now. She understood that she wanted Jordan to hate her. She didn't know why that would be better than anything else, but she knew with certainty in this moment that was the goal.
I wanted to see your face to make sure it was true, Hennessy said.
She shrugged. She could feel her shoulders shrugging even though she hadn't thought about it.
It was like she had manifested something from a dream and was paralyzed, watching herself from above.
The thing she had manifested was this awful Hennessy trying her best to make Jordan break and scream for her to leave.
This is what you came from, Hennessy said, gesturing to herself. And you're using it to become a craft painter and make babies with that white bro? Guess I should have given my mother's memories some credit. They were a safeguard against suburbia.
Quietly, Jordan asked, why do you always do this?
Because Hennessy always dreamt of the lace. That was why. Because it was always the same dream, always the same.
Enjoy your nightmare, she said.
31. Declan remembered the worst dream he'd ever had. It was his last year at Aglenby. He was passing his classes. He had dragged Ronan through his classes with the help of Ronan's friend Gansey. He had bought Christmas gifts for Matthew. He had his internships lined up and the move planned to the townhouse his dead father had left him. He had done the math on the money left in the will and had worked out how much he needed to make and how much he was allowed to spend each year in order to continue to live in the way he thought would be all right to live. He was dating a girl named Ashley, after breaking up with a girl named Ashley. Ashley was thinking of going to school in D.C. to be closer to him. Declan was eyeing a less attentive Ashley to replace her. He was doing his best to keep the noose of malevolent business associates his father had made for them from tightening before he graduated. That was not the worst dream. That was the waking world. The worst dream was this. It was nearly Christmas. There was frost on the colorless grass around the farmhouse at the barns. Neil had just come back from a December business trip, and now he was presenting gifts to his sons, just as he did in real life. He gave Matthew a puppy that was only alive when Matthew was holding it.
I'm never gonna put it down, declared Dream Matthew.
He gave Ronan a textbook with no words in it. My favorite kind, Ronan had said. He gave Declan a box, and in the box was the ability to dream things into life.
Your mother said you'd been asking for this, Neil told him.
Declan woke with a rush of electric adrenaline. Horror pulsed in time with his heart.
He looked around in dread, but his dorm room was just as he'd left it when he slept. There was nothing in it that hadn't been carried with ordinary human hands, that hadn't been crafted with ordinary human labor. There were no miracles or wonders, just his unmagical room with the things he needed for his unmagical life. He had never been so relieved. Declan was looking at El Haleo. He was standing there, arms crossed, head tilted to one side, studying it. A little closer than he would normally be. No, a lot closer than he would normally be.
He had stepped over the chain that ordinarily warned museum-goers to stay out of the alcove, and he was close enough to see the ridges on brushstrokes, to smell the oldness of all the paint in the closed-in space. It felt quite illicit, and he couldn't imagine what had come over him. This close, everything looked a little different than he remembered. It took him a moment to realize that some of his disorientation was not because of proximity. It was because the museum was dark. The dancer was lit only by a dim security light that came through the window to the right of the painting and reflected off the mirror to the left of it. The museum was also silent. The small, close building was never noisy, but right then, it lacked even the murmur of distant people in other rooms, the sound of life, breath held or breath gone, tomb-like. He didn't know how he'd gotten here. He didn't know how he'd gotten here. Declan looked down at himself. He was dressed in the same clothing he'd been in when he'd left Jordan's. Jacket, loosened tie. Same clothing that Declan in the portrait had been wearing. Same clothing that Declan who'd kissed Jordan had been wearing. He remembered returning to the apartment, didn't he? It was possible he was simply remembering other times he had, and all those memories had stacked up to disguise that he was missing one. This was dream logic, not waking logic. He felt awake. He was awake, surely, but...
Neat trick, right? Ronan asked.
The middle Lynch brother leaned casually in the entrance from the courtyard, shoulder against the doorframe, arms crossed, watching him. He had changed since Declan had seen him. Not taller, because Ronan had already been tall, but bigger, somehow. Older. He hadn't shaved in a few days, and he had grizzle that instantly aged him. He was no boy. No student. He was a young man. Ronan, Declan said. He couldn't think of what else to say, how to say it, and so he just shoved everything he wanted to say into that one word.
Ronan.
Ronan said, "The guard will be dazed for a while. The cameras are dazed, too. It's pretty slick. I tried to get him to name it something. The Bedazzler. All caps, but he's not that sort. What do you want to see here? You can see anything, touch anything. No one will know."
Declan was badly disoriented.
"I don't understand." Bride stepped into the room. He was a neat figure, controlled. Declan instantly recognized the posture. Not ego, beyond ego. A man who knew precisely what his boundaries were and operated so thoroughly within them that he was untouchable and knew it. He did not have to lift a fist, raise his voice. He was a kind of powerful that other powerful people respected. He held a small silver orb in between finger and thumb.
"It's quite expensive," he said, studying it. "Requires good lay energy, good dream, perfect focus. Razor focus, really. You have to hold what it means to be human in your head, because you don't want to take that from them. These little baubles have to go off and sin the mind in all directions, but keep those pieces close enough to gather back. There is no point in a treat if it's all trick. You may as well shoot someone if you aren't going to put their minds back. A butcher ruins, a dreamer nudges."
Declan found himself feeling precisely the same sensation as he had after his worst dream. He longed to wake up back in the apartment and find everything ordinary and correct around him.
"I don't trust Bride," Adam had said. And how could he? Look at him. Listen to him. Feel what he could do.
Declan remembered nothing about getting here. Bride had taken it from him. Declan took two steps back, putting himself on the proper side of the chain, protecting El Haleo. Immediately he felt better, giving the painting its space once more. Bride pocketed the orb and told Ronan,
"I let Hennessy think she stole one, so we've got just this one left, so be efficient."
"Where is she?" Declan asked. "Hennessy, I mean. Is she here?"
She's going to see Jordan, Ronan said, and Declan felt a little pang of uncertainty in his gut. To Bride, Ronan said. She was pretty wound up. Do we know that...
She'll be back, Bride said with absolute certainty. She knows where she belongs. Go on. Eye on the clock, this won't last forever.
He pulled back into the dim courtyard, disappearing among the complicated black shadows of the tropical palms and flowers. Declan found himself alone with his brother, experiencing the impression of privacy, if not the reality. He had not seen him since they'd parted on the banks of the Potomac River, and he realized that part of him had been preparing itself for the idea that he might never see him again. It was a worry that he hadn't fully felt until now, that the danger of it had passed and he found his knees wobbly with relief. Ronan, his family, his brother. Older, stranger, but still obviously Ronan.
You heard him, Ronan said. What room have you always wanted to go into? What other rope have you always wanted to step over?
Declan didn't fancy touring the museum under these circumstances, but he wanted some space from Bride to talk to Ronan, so he walked with his brother through the eerie, quiet building. They found themselves standing in the Dutch room, the green wallpaper looking black in the dim. Two empty frames hung on the wall in front of them, one for each of the brothers.
What's the deal here? Ronan asked.
I was about to ask the same.
The empty frames.
Any other time, Declan would have had the whole story at the ready, but tonight he simply said, they were stolen 20 years ago, 30 maybe. It's been a vigil since then. This whole place was made by a woman who wanted it to stay the same even after her death. So after the paintings were stolen out of the frames, the museum hung the frames back on the walls to wait until the... Do you care about this?
You don't care about this. Ronan,
I've been hearing the news. What are you doing?
Sounds like you already know.
I'm worried, Declan said, following Ronan as he began to walk again. Don't forget there's a real world you want to come back to. The point was to get to a place you could do that.
Was it?
Don't do that. I remember what we talked about. Don't pretend it was me telling you how to live. Adam. You wanted Adam.
Adam, Ronan said slowly, as if remembering, as if he were a man enchanted himself. And Declan realized he did not know any of the things Bride could or couldn't do with his dreams. Perhaps this was not even Ronan at all. Perhaps this was a Ronan.
No, he was not going to let himself even picture it. That was the way to absolute madness. The barns, Declan added, voice terse. You told me you wanted to be a farmer.
Ronan's mouth slid to a grin, surprising Declan thoroughly. You remember that.
And now Declan himself was confused because he didn't think Ronan looked nearly as enchanted as he had thought he did a moment before. Now he looked sharp and alive, eyes bright and mirthful.
This isn't about me. It's about people like me. It's not about Matthew. It's about people like Matthew. They don't get to live, but they will. Is that really all this meeting is about? I thought Matthew was having a meltdown. I thought you needed weapons. I thought you needed dreams to build your empire. Cash, cars, girls.
It's a family meeting to make sure you know where you're going to be in 3 years, Declan said. Long-term goals.
Oh, God, it was a meeting for Declanisms? The more things change, blah-de-fucking-la.
What is your plan doing for other people? Are you breaking the world?
Ronan laughed merrily. I hope so.
He had led them back around to the Spanish cloister. Declan did not generally think of Ronan as a particularly timely person, but Bride had told him to be efficient, and he'd been efficient. He had brought Declan right back here without Declan even thinking about how they were being led back here. It was a very dream thing to do. It was a very adult, strategic thing to do. Bride waited in front of El Jaleo, his hands tucked in his pockets, eyes in shadow. His voice was a little knowing.
You could take anything from here, right now.
You could take this painting to hang in your living room and never have to worry about your brother Matthew again.
It had already occurred to Declan that anybody with that impossible dream orb of Bride's could steal anything they liked from this place, do anything they liked.
Declan had heard Bride's hidden threat earlier. The entirety of Declan's memories could have been destroyed for good by an unkindly dreamer.
Declan's hands felt a little shaky.
This museum's already had enough taken from it, Declan said. Even if I didn't care about that, I don't want to walk around with a target on my back. And it fixes very little, as I'm sure you've already considered. Matthew can't wrap that painting around himself and have a normal life. Robbed from this place, and for what? A prison of my apartment?
Good, said Bright.
So you understand what we're doing, then? You want Matthew to live like anyone else.
So do we.
Declan said, you could do this without Ronan.
No, Bride murmured. I could not. There was a sound from somewhere within the museum. Not an alarm, not yet, but movement.
Bride looked up sharply. To Ronan he said, we are nearly out of time. I'll need to use this last one here, and I won't be able to get another one until I am out of the city. It's too loud here.
Declan couldn't think of what to say.
He had thought the conversation was going to come around in his favor, but he was the one going round and round instead. All he could think to blurt to Ronan was, you should see Matthew before you leave Boston, in case...
Yeah, you're right, said Ronan, but he glanced to Bride to confirm.
It was only after Bride nodded imperceptibly that Ronan repeated with certainty,
right.
Bride owned his brother. Completely. 32. 10. That was the number of coffees Carmen Farouk Lane ordered while waiting in the Somerville Cafe. She didn't want to cheaply hold down this table when another paying customer could have it, but she also didn't want to float away on a lake of coffee. She glanced at the time on her phone. 35 minutes had passed since the agreed-upon rendezvous time. When did she give up?
Just one more, please, she told the server.
God, but she was nervous.
She didn't know if she was more nervous about the meeting or being found out by the moderators. She'd resigned right after checking out of the quaint little rental cottage. Just like that. Strip the sheets from the bed, make sure all the dishes were in the dishwasher, turn off all the lights, hide Hennessy's moonlit sword in a linen closet, quit the only job that seemed important. Locke had accepted the keys to the bullet-ridden rental car and had her sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Of course I'm disappointed, Locke had rumbled, but I respect your decision.
Farouk Lane wasn't entirely sure she believed him. The moderators had not been interested in respecting people's decisions before that point. He was less gracious about Liliana's resignation a few minutes after, but Liliana had been insistent, gentle, fair. She cited the mishandling of the Rhiannon Martin job and the emotional scarring of her teen self. She noted that the moderators had not, to that point, seemed to be able to use her visions to make the world a safer place. She reminded them, Farouk Lane's presence had always been part and parcel of her deal with the moderators. No, she could not be persuaded to stay long enough to help find another visionary. Yes, she was sorry to leave them blind, but she wished them luck. Farouk Lane hadn't really thought the moderators would let them go, but they had. She dipped into her parents' bank accounts to buy a car at the closest local dealership, stopped briefly by the rental cottage to retrieve Hennessy's sword, and then left that part of her life in the rearview mirror. Boston was their destination. Liliana had just had a vision. 9 a.m. that morning, Declan Lynch had called to discuss an urgent matter.
I would prefer to have this conversation on the most secure line possible, he murmured. It requires the utmost discretion.
Coincidentally, she had told him, she was in the Boston area. Did he want to meet up in person? She had been intensely grateful that she'd been the one to call him about Ronan Lynch earlier that month. Now, he was late.
Miss Farouk Lane. Declan Lynch stood by the table. He looked like his brother Ronan, but with the edges sanded off, the memorable bits deleted. He had neat, civilized dress slacks, a neat, civilized wool sweater, neat, civilized facial hair, very nice shoes. There wasn't a stitch that was out of place in this upscale cafe full of talkative Tufts students and drowsy medical residents. I didn't see you come in, she said. I came in the back. She saw him check his surroundings, but only because she was watching him closely. He was very good, long practice with paranoia. I'm sorry I'm late. I had to be sure I wasn't followed. She couldn't really believe it. Here he was. Liliana's vision had promised it, but the visions were always things for the moderators to interpret, not her, and they were always for killing Zeds, not attempting anything more nuanced. Of course. Can I get you a coffee? We should be brief, Declan said by way of reply. His voice was vague, nasal. He sounded as if he were announcing a meeting agenda. Unwise to push our luck. 8 minutes was how long it took Declan Lynch to say his piece. I love my brother, Declan said. So know that when I say this next part, I'm saying it from a place of fondness. Ronan's a follower. He's always needed a hero to follow. When he was a kid, he idolized my father. When he was in school, he idolized his best friend. Now he's obviously idolizing this bride. He doesn't get ideas on his own. That sounds bad. Remember I said I loved him. I mean it in the best way. I mean it this way. He's not your problem. Take away bride, and Ronan's just the same as he always was. A kid who's going to go back to Virginia to play with cars and mud and cow shit. Who was running the show when you saw them together? It was Bride, wasn't it? Not my brother. Not Jordan Hennessy. Whose name has been whispered subversively for weeks? Bride's. She tilted her chin. We're in agreement. Bride's the target. Are we in agreement? Because I want to be sure you know why I'm sitting at this table. A co-worker at Alpine Financial had told Farouk Lane once that, neurologically, most people saw their future selves as a totally different person, and so treated them with less empathy, like a stranger. High achievers, though, saw their present and future self as one person, and accordingly made wiser decisions. Farouk Lane had immediately decided that her job as a financial advisor was to close the gap between these two selves. She closed the gap for Declan Lynch. You're here to make sure your family gets a chance to have meaningful adult lives, Farouk Lane said with quiet surety. You're here to make sure there's actually a world for them to have those lives in. You're here because what you saw in Bride scared you, and you want your brother far away from him. Because that's not what your brother stands for, and you don't want his life to be defined by a single decision. You're here talking to me because you're aware you don't have the ability to do this on your own. You're here because you're a good brother. Declan's mouth worked. He was slick enough to know she was also being slick, but he didn't disagree with her. My brother isn't to be harmed, he said. I want to see you say it. The promise wouldn't have meant anything if she were with the moderators, but she wasn't with the moderators. You have my word, Farouk Lane said. 7-3 Park Drive, Boston, Massachusetts. That was all that was written on the card Declan slid across the table as he stood up. That's where they're meeting Matthew. Bride mentioned last night he doesn't have another of the dreams he uses to confuse people, and he can't get any more until they're out of the city. Is it true you killed your own brother? She was taken completely by surprise. You're not the only one who has access to information, he said in that bland way. My brother was a serial killer, she said. He was also a Zed. I didn't pull the trigger, but yes, I helped find him. Your brother's not a serial killer. He's just a Zed. Declan narrowed his eyes. For just the barest second, he did not look at all like he belonged in this nice, civilized cafe. Don't forget your promise, he said, and don't call my brother that.
6. That was the number of scenarios Farouk Lane ran through as she looked at the Park Drive address on various satellite maps. It belonged to a rose garden in the Emerald Necklace, a series of green parks chained through the Boston area. It was a bad location for an attack, right in the middle of the city, right up against the swampy fens that gave Fenway its name, surrounded by the trees that gave Bride his information. But Liliana said Farouk Lane only needed enough time to draw Jordan Hennessy's sword. I'm trusting you, Farouk Lane told Liliana. One sword draw, one second, one death. When it came to it, she could kill someone, she thought, to save the world. She had stood by and helped the moderators kill many others after all. She couldn't erase that, just try to make it matter. One person, one Zed, one sword. She could do it. It wasn't 23 people. It was one. It will turn out all right, Liliana said gently. What happened in the vision? Farouk Lane said. What did I do? Where was it? It will turn out all right, Liliana repeated.
5 minutes after Farouk Lane got to the James B. Kelleher Rose Garden, the moderators found her. Did you think we weren't having you followed, Carmen? Locke rumbled with disappointment. It was hard to tell if he was disappointed in her working without them or not covering her tracks. He held a takeout coffee from the cafe she'd met Declan at, and Farouk Lane couldn't stop staring at it. She'd been careful. She was sure she'd been careful. You're a lot easier to track than a Zed in an invisible car. You know why? You obey the law.
I have a plan here, Farouk Lane said. We want the same thing.
Locke cast a heavy glance at Hennessy's sword. It was hooded safely away in its shoulder scabbard, but its identity was clear. The hilt shouting, from chaos. And it's a plan you think you could execute better cowboy style. I respect what you did here, Carmen, but we can't risk you taking point on this. We'll take it from here. The team's all here. Thanks for the good work.
I made a promise that I'd only take down Bride, Farouk Lane said desperately. I intend to keep that promise.
You'd risk the world on that,
Farouk Lane repeated. I intend to keep that promise. Let me do this, please.
How about this? Locke offered. How about you let us help you keep that promise? Like you said, we want the same thing. And you need our eyes, anyway.
It wasn't as if she had a choice. There was no time. She was outnumbered.
We want the same thing.
But it was only past Farouk Lane who truly believed this now. Present Farouk Lane wasn't sure, and future Farouk Lane, unclear. Okay, Farouk Lane said. She explained the plan. It was a hasty thing, constructed with very few data points. Declan's address and time. Liliana's description of her vision. Farouk Lane's understanding of what Hennessy's sword could do if wielded without hesitation. The plan was skeletal in its simplicity. At the center of the rose garden was a small fountain, a little over a foot deep. It was as far from large trees as one could hope for in the city. There was no evidence that Bride could receive information from roses. Carmen Farouk Lane was going to climb into the fountain, lie down in the nearly frozen water, and breathe sips of air through a straw that reached to the surface. She would wait there in the inhuman temperature until the moderators texted her that the Zeds had arrived in the garden, and then she would leap from the water with Hennessy's sword like an avenging angel, killing Bride with a single moonlit stroke. Her phone was only rated for an hour of underwater use, but the cold would kill her before that anyway. Is this how you saw it? She asked Liliana again. It will be all right, Carmen.
It will be all right.
It did not feel all right as she lay in the bottom of the fountain. She tried to keep her hand from shaking as she held the breathing tube steady in her frigid lips. She focused on a black feather that floated on the surface of the water above her. She was waiting to kill. Waiting to kill. Waiting to kill. She had to think of him as not human, as not living, as simply a tree to hew down. The trees were on his side, though, which meant the trees had feelings, too. Nothing was simple anymore. She was that feather. She was that feather. Her phone buzzed against her. The Zeds were here. 4 seconds passed before she could animate her cold body. She plunged from the water, sword already alive with light and swinging. The blade missed Bride by several inches. Ronan Lynch's raven screamed into the air. Bride's eyes met hers. This was wrong. This was already wrong. It had to be immediate, or it wouldn't work. She couldn't fight them. Anything beyond the single stroke got messy, and anything messy meant she couldn't guarantee her promise. Ronan had his sunfire sword out in a second, but Bride snatched it from him. "Get out of here," snapped Bride. "You know what to do." Farouk Lane didn't have time to see if Ronan obeyed because Bride fell upon her with vexed to nightmare. They fought. They fought. The rose garden was alight with the weapon's eerie glow. Farouk Lane's hands were so frozen that she could barely feel the hilt, but it seemed to her the sword wanted her to succeed. Even as her fingers were too numb to guide it, the blade chose an effective path for itself. However, Bride's blade wanted him to succeed too, and so a battle waged. It did not matter that neither Farouk Lane nor Bride were swordsmen. The swords were made to fight, and they would fight, and Farouk Lane and Bride would wield them. Rose bushes shredded, stone planters cleaved, trellises sprung in all directions like split rib cages. But neither the sunfire blade nor the starlit blade took any damage. She had been right when she guessed the only match for From Chaos was this other sword. She was tangentially aware that outside the vivid light of the blades, moderators and Zeds fought. Gunfire sounded. The sword's furious dripped light both warmed Farouk Lane's chilled body and repelled bullets, slicing them as easily as they sliced anything else. Bullets! She was breaking her promise. Declan Lynch had come to her and asked for her help and gotten her word. She'd really believed it when she promised him Ronan would be untouched. The moderators had been killing Zeds, and now they were going to kill her integrity, too. This felt more intolerable than anything else to this point. She'd promised. "I only want you," Farouk Lane shouted to Bride as the swords met again. "If you really want the others to get away, you'll give up. We know it's you. I know it's you." Bride said, "You don't know anything you think you know, Carmen Farouk Lane." "Don't play your mind games with me," she shouted. "I don't play games," Bride said. "I just turn down the volume on the shit that doesn't matter."
Suddenly she was hit from behind. The blow hit the middle of her spine so sharply that her knees buckled. There was no arguing with it. She was down on her knees, and then she was down on her face. Gravel bit her lips. She felt the winning sword tumbling from her hand. She felt her vision flicker. She felt everything going wrong. Gunfire speckled like the sound of castanets behind a dancer. She heard someone shout. She had trusted Liliana. It was supposed to be all right.
3 Zeds bolted from the rose garden. They were on foot. They had to be.
One of them had smashed their dripped hoverboard across Farouk Lane's back. This was why her spine stung, why she still felt pain shooting up to her neck and her fingertips. This was why Hennessy's sword burned the dry grass a few inches away from her as she gingerly sat up. This was how Bride had gotten away. She could hear shouts, more gunfire, sirens, all moving farther and farther from her. This was wrong. All wrong. The moderators were driving the Zeds to ground and breaking her promise all in one. Declan Lynch had trusted her. She had trusted Liliana. She trusted herself. The deepest wound was one she didn't even understand. Bride's voice said in her head, "You don't know what you think you know." Just words. Just words from a Zed. Then why did she want to cry? Liliana leaned to help her up. "It will be all right," she said. Two of them stood in the rose garden. Farouk Lane leaned over and replaced Hennessy's sword in the scabbard. The grass beneath it was a burned ruin. The entire garden was a ruin. These old roses torn up. The gravel path shredded deeply. The fountain tinted an ugly shade with just a bit of someone's blood. Everything was worse off than when they'd gotten there. The moderators had vanished, chasing after the Zeds. But Farouk Lane knew it didn't matter. Bride would get away. The second her first swing had missed him, he was always going to get away. She'd known that. "I trusted you," she said to Liliana. Liliana gestured for Farouk Lane to look behind her.